States Eventing Association's official podcast. Hello, I'm Chris Stafford, and on this week's episode, we're going to continue our countdown to this year's Alltech FEI World Equestrian Games in Normandy as we hear from some of the previous team members and medalists from past World Equestrian Games. We start with Mike Huber and Dorothy Kroll. Mike was a member of the team at the 1990 Stockholm Games in Sweden, riding Pedigree Phoenix, where he finished 18th. The team finished 4th, and members included Mike Plum and Chagall, who finished 24th, David O'Connor with Wilton Fair, who finished 35th, and the individual bronze medalist was Bruce Davidson with Pirate Lion. Mike also rode in the 1994 World Equestrian Games with Hoopy, where he finished 31st. Mike, welcome to the program. We're going to take you down memory lane now with a retrospective of the World Equestrian Games as we build up to this year's Alltech FEI World Equestrian Games in Normandy. But as you well know, it all began in its current format in 1990 in Stockholm, and you were there.
Yeah, I was. It was a great experience. And actually, I had gone the year before because they had the test event, which was at the three-star level, and I went the year before, and that was while I was living in Europe. So I had been there before, but never prior to that test event. I had never been to Sweden before, and it was just, and that, of course, was still in the days with the long format, and the roads and tracks would go literally through town because the cross-country venue was in a park right in the middle of town, so roads and tracks would go, you know, through town on trails and through the park and so forth, where you know, people were doing their thing on a daily basis, you know, laying out and having picnics, and it was quite amazing, barely knowing what was going on. So it was a great experience, a great venue.
Well, as you say, you've been there before, you competed internationally, you've been on the team, you were back there in 1978 at the World Championships in Kentucky, but this was new format, Mike. What were your impressions going into this? Did you think that this format would work and that it would bring more people from other sports to watch the event in competition?
Well, you know, I don't know that I had much of a preconceived idea. I think everybody thought it was a good concept. I'm not sure that it has worked because a lot of sports people really like their particular sports. I mean, when I say they're fans, they're fans of dressage, or they're fans of show jumping, and that's what they want to see. So I think, you know, you get probably 75% of the people go to see their venue, you know, their particular sport go on, and then they probably take off. I think, you know, the amount, and I certainly don't have the statistics, so I'm not qualified to say, but I would think it would be a very few that would go for, you know, 2 weeks and sort of watch it all, if you will. Maybe I'm dead wrong, but what it does do, though, is it does bring certainly the highlight of equestrian sports to that particular venue, which, you know, in the old days when you had, you know, the World Championships and you'd have each discipline in a different city and so forth, it was just like sort of another event. So now you're bringing it together more like the Olympic Games, which I would probably say the same thing about the Olympic Games. You buy tickets for the, you know, for the sports you want to see, you go, and you might get to see, you know, more than one, you know, of what you wanted to see, but it's not necessarily indicative of the entire competition.
So tell us about your preparation then, and when you got the call up, was that a surprise, or did you think, well, I've got a good shot at getting on the team now with the way the horse is going?
Well, right. In for Stockholm in 1990, I was living in Europe. I had three really good horses. And I would say that overall sort of from, you know, 1987 to 1990 was sort of the highlight of my career, really. So at that point in time, I felt quite confident that if my horse was sound and so forth, that I that I had a pretty good shot to be on that team, and that's the way it worked out. You know, in 94, 4 years later, it was a little bit different because I was had a new horse and was living back in the States and just had one horse at that level. Actually going to The Hague was really a result, unfortunately, of Stephen Bradley's horse, Sassy Reason, having a problem in the final gallop, that actually got me there. But it, for Stockholm, it was, I felt very, very, I felt at the top of my, you know, top of my game at that point in time. So I felt quite confident that I would get there.
So tell us about the horse and how that competition unfolded for you, Mike, because you finished, I believe, 18th, didn't you?
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. I rode a homebred of my mother's called Phoenix, who is a lovely horse. I ended up going first on the team, which I actually sort of wanted to do. It was an interesting course. It was quite different than what a lot of us were accustomed to, sort of the course design there. And this horse had really, he'd gone around badminton that particular year, earlier in the year, and the year before, both clear and, you know, on the cross country. That was his strong suit, was cross country. And they had sort of an unusual sort of combination early in the course that you either had to drop down a drop to a bounce vertical, which was quite unusual. You didn't really see that, still don't actually to this day. And because I was first rider on the team, we decided that I should, because we didn't know how that would ride as a team, that I would take the quote longer route. And as it turns out, he jumped. In that particular way, he jumped down a little bit awkward to get to the long route and ended up having a stop there. And I think on hindsight, had I not had the stop, I think I would have finished sixth pretty much if you kind of figure the time and so forth. So that was sort of a, you know, a bummer, because later in the day it did prove that the other route rode okay, but because I was first one out, you know, didn't have that information. So I was trying to do the right thing as the first ride around, and it's you always feel as a rider, if you take the longer route, you know, don't mess it up, because that should be a given. You know, you do it because it's a safer route. In this case, the safer route proved to not be so safe.
Right. Well, that was an all-male team you had there, wasn't it? As you said, you were riding Pedigree Phoenix, yeah. And David O'Connor was on Wilton Fair. J. Michael Plum was on Chagall, and Bruce Davidson with Pirate Lion. A very experienced team, though, Mike.
Yeah. I mean,
how did you think you would fare up? I mean, you only just finished outside the medals as a team, and that was pretty close, too.
That's right. I mean, it was disappointing with some of, because we had sort of some, you know, a couple of, you know, hiccup, you know, in that day on the cross country, and to still be still finish fourth kind of gave you the feel that the course was riding quite difficult. It did ride hard, and it was obviously disappointing not to come away with a team medal. That was very disappointing, because I felt with, you know, with the, you know, Bruce, you know, finished third individually that year. And, you know, I felt like with the horsepower and the rider power we had, we should have had a medal. And so that, you know, to this day is sort of, you know, something that kind of, you know, doesn't sit well.
That still stings a little bit after all these years.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely.
But in terms of the whole impression of the competition and how it unfolded and what you took away from it, Mike, what will be your other fond memories?
Well, I think that they, besides the fact it was difficult to sleep because it was light 20 hours a day, besides that, it was a terrific venue that, and they put on a great event, and I did have the opportunity, by the way, to watch you know, the dressage. That was when, I'm trying to think of the Rembrandt, when Rembrandt was the star of the day for the dressage, and got to see that one go. So it was fun to see that. I think that, you know, in hindsight, considering that was the very first World Equestrian Games, I think they did a great job. I mean, they really did. I think they probably, you know, now my second one was at The Hague, which was the second World Equestrian Games, but they were the ones that got the shorter end of the stick as far as the time to get ready, because The Hague wasn't the one that was originally picked, and they only had, you know, I think a year or two to put that together, which, you know, in hindsight, that was quite an accomplishment in itself. You know, since then, with, you know, places like Aachen and Kentucky, they've, you know, put, there's just a lot more, I think, probably sponsorship, but a lot more money. And I think people have figured out, you know, what it takes to put one on. So I have to say for Stockholm, when, you know, first of all, eventing, you know, I mean, Sweden over history, in fact, they did very well early on, and back in the 40s and 50s, they were quite strong, but it's not noted as, you know, sort of like Germany or America or Britain, Australia, as being, you know, an eventing powerhouse. They did, I thought, a spectacular job in putting on the competition, and you know, that still being in the days of the long format, which, you know, obviously for the eventing portion is just that much more to deal with for the organizing committee. I think they did a great job.
Well, let's go on.
I remember. Funny enough, the weather. You know, you would think, you know, for people here in North America, you would that. You know, the weather would be cool and, you know, gorgeous, and there was quite an issue with the heat there. You know, in the summertime, what people don't realize is, even though it's way far north, but when you have 20 hours of sunshine, it can get quite warm, and they had issues. And I one of the things I remember distinctly, and I think this is maybe the most important thing I could tell you, is that our veterinarian, Dr. Marty Simonson, at the time, who was our head veterinarian, they had some horses, and there was a horse, and I can't remember which horse Ian Stark rode that day, but the horse was having basically a heat stroke coming off of the course.
Yes, and that was Murphy himself, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right, and remember that. The British grooms, who are obviously not accustomed to the heat, because that was, you know, long before the Atlanta Olympics, and that's, I think this may have been, maybe that day was the start of sort of the heat study type thing. But I remember Marty Simonson watching the British grooms, who had never experienced anything like this before, and they were, you know, putting, you know, like they had little washcloth type things of, you know, patting the horse down with water, and Marty realizing what was happening, and this was for an opposing team, he stepped in and he went. He said, "You got to be drastic here," and called for the American grooms to bring buckets with ice and ice water, and basically, literally drown this horse in water, ice water, to keep him alive. And I think that, to me, probably, if I think about one thing, you know, about, you know, sportsmanship in the world, about how our veterinarian, you know, basically saved, you know, a horse from another country because it's the right thing to do, and he, you know, he's a veterinarian, and that's what you do. And I thought that was fantastic, and the horse did true. But, you know, he said later to me, he said, you know, if we'd not done that, that horse is going to die.
Yes.
And so I thought that was, you know, that was something I took away from, sometimes it's more than the competition. So I thought that was really, really neat.
Absolutely. Yes. It's all about sportsmanship. Well, I want to take you on those 4 years then to The Hague in the Netherlands. And that was an interesting, you talk about the heat on cross country day out at the military camp where the cross country took place was extraordinary, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, once again, you think you're in Holland, or you think you're in Sweden, and you think you'll be fine, but it can be hot anywhere in the world. And yeah, it was hot again. My horse, did pretty well. He was an English thoroughbred. I rode Hoopoo that year, but it was definitely hot. And I remember there, one of the things that I think really contributed, unfortunately, for the cross country horses are right, but it was a very sandy course, and where we had to do the roads and tracks again. This was still a long format. Some of the places on the roads and tracks were just very, very heavy going sand. I mean, it was like trying to trot, at the beach, not on the water edge where the sand is firm, but up by, where it would be very deep and heavy. And the roads and tracks was just exhausting for the horses. And I think that really, really, really made a difference for many of them, and sort of set the stage for a difficult cross country day.
It did, and it was, of course, at a different venue. It was at the military base out in the country.
Yeah,
it was
a long way away, which was, what was nice, for example, at Stockholm, but you literally could, get out of your hotel room, and because you were right in town, you could literally walk to the venue. In this case, you had to drive, we were bused down there, which, just to walk the course and stuff, which is obviously not as convenient as what you would have at Kentucky or places like that, venues like that.
Right. But the rest of the competition, the dressage and the show jumping, of course, was in downtown The Hague, very central.
Right, right.
And a very
yes,
temporary
absolutely.
Facility again.
Right, right.
So
yeah, go ahead.
I was just wondering how that unfolded for you then in terms of your test. Was it what you expected? And then the show jumping, did you have the horse that you needed going into the show jumping?
My horse turned out to be more tired. I had an uncharacteristic stop in the show jumping, actually, on the horse I had there, because he was really more tired than I'd ever felt him. And I think a lot of that came from that roads and tracks the day before. But this horse is a very good show jumper and quite an honest horse, but I had, he was tired. And I remember in the triple combination that he jumped in a little bit and just had to stop. And I had never felt him, I don't say he gave up, but he was just exhausted. So he was very exhausted.
And another very warm day there, but another memorable event, another obviously being part of the World Championship team again, more great memories for you, Mike, to take away.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I loved that. It was kind of fun for me to go back for that event because I had lived in Europe for a while and then had come home, and then this was sort of my first time back after having lived there. So it was a good time. It was fun.
Great. Well, great memories, Mike, as we get closer to this year's Alltech FEI World Equestrian Games in Normandy. So I'm sure you'll be following the teams with interest as usual.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Not being a collector anymore. It's a little bit different, but certainly, I wish the best for our team, and I think we have some good horses and riders, and I look forward to a great competition.
Well, thank you very much indeed for coming on the show and sharing your memories with us of the World Equestrian Games. Thank you, Mike.
You're very welcome, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Our next guest is Dorothy Kroll, who won the individual silver medal at the 1994 World Equestrian Games in The Hague, the Netherlands, riding Molokai. And in addition to Dorothy and Mike Huber, who rode Hoopy, as we heard, and finished 31st, David O'Connor rode On a Mission and finished 44th. Jim Graham with Easter Parade and Bruce Davidson with Eagle Lion were both eliminated, but Karen O'Connor finished 11th with Biko. Hi, Dorothy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much.
Well, we're going to take a walk down memory lane today, taking you back to 1994 and The Hague, where you finished as the silver medalist on Molokai with a score of 56.8. Now, you don't need me to remind you that you picked up those 2.4 time penalties on the steeplechase. Do you rue those time penalties to the day, Dorothy, when you look back at those scores, thinking you could have been on the top of the podium if it wasn't for those?
Actually, I don't mean to sound trite, but actually I really don't. There are many things that I rue. There are many times that I've missed to a show jump and maybe lost the lead, shall we say, Rolex in 98, that I really do regret. But that isn't one of them. Molokai, in the end, we know, stepped on his shoe while galloping, pulled it up just enough to come back down on some nails and clips, and basically was nearly three-legged for a few strides. And so I immediately pulled him up. Maybe if I'd been more experienced, I would have taken note of my watch before I started to pull him up so that I would have known how much time had elapsed. But I pulled him up to the trot. By the time I got him to the trot, he was leveling out. He trotted for a few steps. Then I picked up the gallop again. I had trotted past my minute marker, so I basically wasn't quite sure where I was. But at that point, I pretty much just, once I knew he was okay or apparently okay, I just went as fast as I could, and it was strangely probably one of my fondest memories, because that is maybe the only time in my life with Mo that I actually allowed him to go absolutely as fast as he could, and to a fence, and it was a rush. It was that last minute or so was an amazing ride. It's unfortunate that it prevented us from getting the gold medal, but in the end he was okay, and we did all right.
Well, you certainly did all right, bringing home the only medal from that World Equestrian Games. So let's just take a little step back even further, Dorothy, at the whole of that performance. Let's go with the first impressions, really, of The Hague, because it was downtown. We had the cross-country way out at the military center, which was quite a trek, wasn't it, going out there for the cross-country day, and it was the most extraordinary hot conditions too. I think record temperatures for that weekend.
And our stalls were barely 10 by 10, and the grooms had nowhere to sleep other than in a school that had no air conditioning and no showers. They were expected to bathe with the sinks and the waters, the water, Anyway, and so the grooms ended up sleeping in the lorries, in back where the horses go, and taking showers at the ground, cold, hose showers. And there were a lot of distractions, drivers that maybe didn't know exactly where they were going and didn't necessarily speak English. There were a lot of distractions. I think that most team competitions, it's the distractions that do more damage than anything else.
But for you and your preparation with Mo, how was it going into the games, and how confident were you that you could turn in that kind of performance that weekend?
I was actually probably more confident than in any other time in my life. I'm not sure how much of that. I'd had some amazing fundraising done for me. It was definitely the only time through the entire season that I had no financial worry. And I just have to wonder how much that played into the rest of my life as well. I knew that if anything needed to be done, I had the money to pay for it, so I could really settle down and concentrate on what I needed to do to be successful. I knew that Mo was getting better and better in the dressage. He did do the best dressage test of his career, and that was in no small part to Mark Phillips just having the patience to just stay on it. He never gave up on us, which I really appreciate. And I was I was very, very confident that we were prepared as far as cross-country riding was concerned, right up until I walked the course. and came around the corner at the top of the hill and looked down the hill at the bounce into water, which was a rail. The initial rail for the bounce was hanging off the edge of the ground. So in other words, you came down the hill and there was a revetted edge and then you could see water and then there was a hanging rail and then you landed on ground and then you had the same thing again, revetted edge, water, rail out into the water. And that was a bounce at the bottom of a ski hill on a hot day. Anyway, you couldn't have built something that would more instill more terror in my brain. yeah, but we got through it.
How many times did you walk the course?
My usual routine was to walk it 4 to 5 times. So I'm sure I probably walked it 5 times.
So over those course of those 4 or 5 times, how many times did you walk it alone, and when was the last time you walked it?
I would have walked it 3 times alone, the last time I walked it would have been, I didn't get to go in any of the phases of the world until dinner time for horses, so it was, you know, around 4:30, 5 o'clock late. So the last time I walked it would have been the morning of the world, and then I do remember parking myself in a car, and just so I couldn't hear what was going on. I think I read a book, actually, just trying to distract myself. So,
was that the usual strategy for you then, to distract yourself from what was happening, especially going so late in the day?
Yes. Yeah. Otherwise, I just would hear things. If I heard people that I considered to be better riders than me having trouble, it kind of undid me. So I just didn't listen. I didn't want to know.
Right. Well, of course, by that time, 4 o'clock, it was as hot as it had been all day. It was just getting hotter and hotter out there. It was blistering heat. And that was the course where, of course, the driving marathon was held as well. It had gathered quite a crowd out there. So what was the atmosphere like by the time you set off, Dorothy?
It was, as you said, hot. The sand was getting kind of deep on the roads and tracks. And I was worried about Mo. That might have built into when I felt him lose his rhythm and on the steeplechase to Raya, so quickly pulled him up. But I have to say, once again, I mean, I'm obviously a thoroughbred snob. I'm from Lexington, Kentucky. I grew up in a thoroughbred family, so yeah, I'm a bit of a thoroughbred snob. And he was the best of that breed, I think. He was an old-fashioned thoroughbred with huge heart and an engine that just didn't stop. And he was fine. I kept checking, are you okay? Are you okay? Even on course, there was a place where Mark said, you know, this is where you let off for a moment and check and make sure you've got gas in the tank. And so I let off and he went faster. And I went, okay. You're fine. I don't know how you're fine, but you're fine.
So talk us through that course then, and obviously going through the water, which you were apprehensive about, but, you know, it obviously worked out for you. But talk us through that track and how he pulled up with you.
It was definitely not the only thing I was worried about. There was plenty to be worried about. But when I got in the box, Mark said that I needed to come out as fast as I, you know, could. He said, come out, pedal to the metal, because you're going to need to take more time later in the course. And that always, with Molokai, who was such a forward-minded horse and a little bit crazy as well, that kind of set me back, because I had spent years coming out quietly, and then building to make sure he kept his brain in his head. But if there was ever a time to, as they say, pull the trigger, it was now. So we did it, and it was sort of like in the steeplechase, a blast. It was a blast. So he came out. He was obviously on. I was staying on, and there were a few other ones. There was a big yawing ditch that you jumped across up onto a bank, a rising bank that you went up and over, and then you had to drop down and do a sharp turn to an angled fence. And I'd heard that Blythe had had trouble there. So once again, like, definitely a better rider than me. Oh my gosh. And so I was happy when I got through that one. There were some serious, there was a big old corner that I was a bit afraid of, and Mo, of course, bailed over it. But for sure, the signature fence that was like an evil creature at the bottom of the hill waiting to eat me was that Water Johnson. And once I got through it, I was able to breathe and ride with some confidence. And for sure, like I said, we got to the place where we're supposed to check the gas in the tank. He was fine. He was still, I mean, I was still having to ask him to whoa, as opposed to just think whoa and they slow down because they're tired. I was still having to stand up and take a bit of a tug to the second to last fence, which was a combination. And that made me feel great. And he finished within the time without really an issue. I would like to say without effort, but then it does seem like I was truly just a passenger. And I did do a little bit of work.
I'm sure you did. How old was he at the games?
Oh, wow. Now this is getting tough. Okay. He was, I would guess, 9. I'm going to think he was 9. He wasn't old. I know that. I remember having that conversation with Mark Phillips when he didn't realize how, quote-unquote, young he was. And I said, but he's only 9. Mark was kind of excited about that.
Well, so. A fabulous performance and finished well at the show jumping ahead of you. How were you feeling by the time you went to bed that night?
Well, I was concerned because show jumping is obviously not my strongest phase. And also I was concerned about Mo, the blacksmith in the box after steeplechase, did a great job of, you know, fixing the shoe, but he still was feeling the effects of having done that. And we were working quite hard on keeping the swelling out. And I just wasn't sure what I was going to have. He jogged up sound that morning, but I still, you know, he was still dealing with it. And so I wasn't sure how he was going to feel landing off of the big fences. And I actually went up to the warm-up with it in my mind that if he landed and he was obviously in pain, I was going to have to pull up. I wasn't going to be able to go. But from the very first fence he jumped, he was classic Mo. You know, it was like riding a deer. There was never any effort. You never felt effort. It just, you came up to these great big huge fences, and then poof, you were on the other side without any real appreciable power. You know, that was what was so amazing about him is a rooting horse's sense that could jump big fences, and you could feel the power, and that's cool. But with Mo, it was effortless. There was no feeling of coil and boom, none of that. You just were on the other side. Like it was a 2-foot fence. Even if it was the Centaur's Leap at Burley, you just were on the other side. And that gives you great confidence. Great confidence.
Absolutely. Now what about the atmosphere though in that show jumping arena? Because it was a very different arena to what you're used to, wasn't it? It wasn't full. It was a little bit spacious, sort of tinny, and obviously downtown, right in the middle of The Hague, temporary facilities, as we know. What was it like to ride in?
Wow. You just told me a whole bunch of stuff about that arena that I had no idea existed. I have to tell you, I didn't notice any of it. I guess, you know, the old tunnel vision, focus, whatever you call it. I don't have any memory of what was around me. I have a memory of the warm-up area, attending to whether or not Mo felt good, trotting through the gap, going in and riding my course, and then coming out knowing that he would gone clean. I didn't notice any of that.
Now, what you would have noticed was, of course, when you knew that you'd won the silver medal, that Vaughan Jeffries, the New Zealander with bounce, had taken the gold medal, and you'd finished ahead of Britain's Karen Davis-Dixon with Get Smart, and there you were about to have that silver medal hanging around your neck. What was the feelings that you reflect on now? I mean, they're memories to last a lifetime, aren't they?
Absolutely, and it's what every kid dreams about, you know, to stand on a podium and smile at your parents. I had the love of my life there, John Kroll, who I've been married to now for 18 years and been with for over 20. And that was incredibly special, to be able to share that with him. He was there grooming for Karen O'Connor with Deco. And so it was, not to sound like Disney World, but it was, you know, it was everything that you would dream that it could and would be, to be able to share that with people that you love, to be able to stand in between two people who you know are amazing horsemen and horsewomen, and to know that for once I was able to allow my horse to be the champion that I knew he always knew he was, It was just a matter of whether or not I could produce it for him. So it was an amazing, wonderful, gratifying feeling that has sustained me through many lows that horses always bring you, and bolstered me in the highs, for sure.
Well, clearly a career highlight for you. Were there tears when you were on the podium?
I think I was okay until literally they hung the medal around my neck, and then I stood up, and then I found Mom and Dad in the crowd. And then, of course, there might have been a few tears then.
Well, I was going to ask you, who else was there? John, obviously, grooming for Karen, your parents. Who was grooming for you?
Jackie Ballantyne, and wow, that should have been not the last thing I thought of saying. Jackie Ballantyne, I met in England when we were trying to go to Barcelona, when I was the reserve, when Molokai and I was a traveling reserve. She was actually grooming for somebody else at that point, but she fell in love with Mo, and we struck up a friendship, and then she, you know, was always there for Mo for the rest of his career. And she was amazing. She was great. She was somebody that I could say, I want to get on at this time, and then I could stay out of the barn, which was a good thing because I would make Mo nervous. So he loved her, and he relaxed around her, and he trusted her, and she definitely was a huge part of our success.
Anyone else there that you want to remember?
Well, my aunt Jody, Jody Ryder Trapp, she is the one who gave me the down payment to purchase Molokai. I bought him off the track for $5,000, and she gave me the first $1,000 to be able to do it. And she definitely helped make that season financially free of worry. And without her, once again, you know, it wouldn't have happened. So having her there was an amazing thing. So those would have been my core of supporters, for sure.
And the celebrations have hopefully started that evening. Much champagne flowing for a few days?
Well, okay. So do you want me to continue the Disney, or do you want me to tell you the truth?
But how about both?
Okay. Well, I'll do the truth first, and then the true, which is a little bit Disney later, which is, there was not a whole lot of that. We were mostly trying to take care of the horses, get them ready to ship back the next day, trying to deal with the weather and the heat and the keeping things comfortable. And, you know, it was the reality of dealing with horses. So there was, I'm not going to say there was no champagne. There was definitely champagne. And there were, you know, there were lots of celebrations that I was shuttled around to, by the team, different parties that for the sponsors that had made it possible for all of us to get there. So there was a lot of that. That was kind of a blur. The main thing I remember is, you know, making sure Mo was okay and ready to be shipped back the next day. But then I finally got to sort of really have a moment with my parents, and they said that as a celebratory gift, they were going to send John and I to see. I think my mom was really excited that there finally might have been a guy I was going to marry. They were going to send John and I to Baden-Baden, which is an old-fashioned, you know, five-star, super fancy place that in my real world lifetime I will never ever be able to afford to do. And so they sent us there for 3 nights and 4 days, and that probably might be why we're married. It was romantic. It was amazing. It was beautiful. It was like being in Downton Abbey. It was like being in a movie. So it was just unbelievable. And as I said to him, we don't really need to have a honeymoon. We've had our honeymoon before our wedding, but that's great.
Well,
so our honeymoon could never, you know, because we couldn't afford to do anything like that. So our honeymoon will never be quite that special, though it was wonderful. So yeah, good, you know, Disney and reality mixed together, as horses often do for you.
Yes, terrific memories. So where is that silver medal now, Dorothy? Does it have a pride of place at home?
Oh, I can see John Holling raising an eyebrow. So, okay. So I continued, you know, to be homeless. I was homeless when I won the medal, and I continued to be homeless, an equine vagabond or gypsy. I basically went wherever I needed to go and wherever financially would be beneficial to go to further Mo's career. And I didn't actually have a real home until about 4 years later. So I left the medal with my parents, and they put it in a safe deposit box. It stayed there even when I did have a home, because I was still so on the road all the time. The home I had was more like just a place to drop bags. And so the two things happened recently. We actually built our house. We built the house that we moved into last summer. And a couple of years before that, my father died. And so we opened the safe deposit box in there with my medal. And so it got put in a very, you know, in a box, because we were at that point in the middle of tearing down the house we were in and putting things in the pod. So it got put in the pod, in the box. I have it. It's not lost. But it might still be in the box. There are about 50 of them down in the garage. It might still be in there. I'm going through, you know, I try to do about a box, at least box a month of unpacking. And I haven't reached it yet, but I know it's in there. And when I do, it has a place of honor that it is going to go next to. I've got pictures from, you know, from Mo's career and from Radio Flyers and, you know, everything in life. That are on a big long wall in the house, and it has a spot that's waiting for it when I get to that box. I've considered digging through until I find it, but it's sort of my carrot to make me go through all those darn boxes. Otherwise, they would be down there until I die, and my daughter would have to deal with it. So there's a look into my psychology.
So a treasure yet to be rediscovered, shall we say.
Rediscovered. You got it. Well said, as always. Well said.
All right, Dorothy. Well, that was a wonderful trip down memory lane. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Thank you so much for joining us and celebrating your silver medal from the 1994 World Equestrian Games.
Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate it. It was fun.
And we'll be hearing from more of those team members who made their mark on the World Equestrian Games over the years as we continue with our countdown to this year's Alltech FEI World Equestrian Games in Normandy. Don't forget, you can download all of these podcasts on iTunes and listen to them on the go. Until the next time, enjoy your eventing.